Accession number 30638, Mr. Peter Wayne, Rail 11. So anything, what happened when you got to, I mean, so the dreadful, the war damage and the shortage of food.
It was the war damage and the shortage of food. I mean, I had, of course, as you imagine, the referring again to the Oetker car, it was a huge vehicle, and as I said, I had been, I knew my aunt was alive, and the colonel sat in the back, but there were, it was a six-seater, in fact, and around his feet were corned beef tins, bread, bottles. He knew I was visiting a relative. It was my mother's sister, and we had, by that time, naturally, our relationship was not really that of sergeant major and colonel. It was really a little more personal. So he was, the car was fully laden with goodies. The driver and Colonel Usher were deposited. He dropped me first because, of course, he was going on to officers' quarters, and I saw my aunt, who was, as you can imagine, it was a very emotional reunion, and she also told me one or two things which were very interesting, which people are perhaps not aware. During the last day, days of the war, on the lampposts, and Berlin had plenty of lampposts, were hanging the bodies of German soldiers who were hanged by Nazi officers because they had said it's ridiculous to carry on. We are not going to win this war. This was a capital offense. And she said this horrible sight of German soldiers. I could only stay about a week, and but I did. I did succeed. I remember her house, or flat, or part of the house, was in the American sector of Berlin. In those days, there was no wall, but the Berlin was divided into sectors. And I went up to the American headquarters, spoke to the senior officer, told him the story of my background and, of course, my aunt's background. And he immediately put her onto the higher ration allocation, which meant she got the same rations as what they used to call heavy workers, which she was not. But so I then returned to my military government department. In a way, I was very glad, because it was horrible to see a town which, where I grew up, so flattened. And of course, then going back to a place which was relatively untouched by this. We had, at that time, one of the smaller towns, I think it was called Vloto, we had found a Jewish survivor of the Holocaust. We made him mayor of this little town, and he said to us, and I spoke to him sort of privately in confidence, he said, you know, I don't really feel safe in this job. The Germans, you can't change them overnight. I really feel that I don't want to be the mayor, because I'm sure they'll murder me within a week of being in office. It was then that I realized it's going to be a very hard job. As history has told us, taught us, it's taken two or three generations.
They didn't murder him, though.
No. But he
was worried.
He was worried, but of course he had. We allocated some military personnel to that little place, that town. They were stationed there, and they looked after things, and saw to it that nothing untoward happened. We were then again selected, or rather interviewed, whether we would like to stay on. They were extremely short of interpreters who had an English education and who had a slight knowledge of legal affairs, and who had a second language. And Colonel Usher did try to persuade me unsuccessfully that I should stay on. However, because of my age, I was 25 at the time, I was not demobilized until October 1946.
Now, anything else happened in 40? I mean, we've got to sort of, I mean, I can understand if it's just more of the same, but anything else happened between, well, what, Christmas, January, you know, when you got back from Berlin to October? Any other big things happened that you remember? Or was it just more of this court?
It was really more of this court. We at that time we were very busy, apart from the court work, with the denazification process.
Now tell me about the denazification.
The denazification process really covered the whole of Germany and every German adult citizen. We were issued by headquarters with, in German it's called a Fragebogen, which in English is a questionnaire. The questionnaire consisted of about 100 questions, apart from, and every adult. And you can imagine.
What kind of questions?
The questions started with their personal data. They were virtually very in-depth questionnaires about the political, financial, military background of every grown-up citizen. It was a momentous job, and it did, in fact, we had to employ German personnel as well,
who were to translate all of this.
Later, we were looking for people like who were in opposition. Well, there were hardly any, but we did usually choose people like those few Jewish people whom we could find, who had quite an axe to grind with the Germans. We knew that they would insist on getting the right information out of them. It was really, we acted as policemen at that stage. It was a policing job, and you had to really interview them in depth, and you had to say.
So you got the questionnaires. Then would there be interviews on top of that?
Yes. They were asked to fill them in, and then there followed the in-depth interview.
And you would do them.
And we would do.
What were they like?
The interviews? Well, in some cases, they said, I was not ever a member of the Nazi Party, but we had records. We had records. So I said, well, I understand you attended In June 1939, you attended the Nuremberg rally as a representative of your village. And then the chap said, well, yes, well, and then, of course, the whole case collapsed, and we marked them as being active.
Would you only interview those that seemed likely to be active Nazis?
No.
Or
we would go
every single person?
No. It was a form of selection, rather like the Auschwitz selection, you know.
But you saw everybody.
We did see everybody. We covered every member, and I think.
And what would happen to the identified Nazis? Would they go for trial, or would they? Depending on the grade of Nazis.
Yes. No. We submitted these. We submitted these forms, and I think quite a few were later on were taken to court. We filled in. We were not called as witnesses anymore. But we had to sign these things that we interviewed the people. And as I said before, nobody at first admitted to being Nazi. When these horrible things were published and well known, of course, their cases sometimes broke down completely. But the Germans had to select people who were active and who were what is called in German Mitläufer, which means they were just pragmatists who said, well, I've got a job and two children, well, why can't I join the party? We were trying to find people like Bormann and the really big Nazis, but a lot of them escaped, of course, to South America.
Anything else about denazification? Was there an education side as well? Or was it just identifying Nazis and then punishing or monitoring them?
Yes. The educational side was carried out by the Army Educational Corps, and some of my colleagues and interpreters were actually attached to that. You mustn't forget.
There was a re-education process for the fellow travellers, of the Nazis and the pragmatists.
Yes.
I presume they didn't bother trying to re-educate the hardened Nazis. They
no,
went for trial.
No, they didn't. On the military side, this is, you probably have heard about it, they were actually, some of the senior officers were sent to England for re-education courses. They were, which was done here. We were dealing with a civilian population.
How did they treat you, the Germans? I mean, they must have known you were German because of the accent.
Well, it was relatively easy to get away with the situation by saying, well, I my name is Peter Howard Wayne. I have a German mother, which was absolutely true. And I was brought up bilingually.
So you just didn't tell them?
No, we were actually advised.
Why not? I mean, I can see why, but can you just tell us why, if you see what I mean?
Well, I think it was pointless, and we wanted to maintain our strict position of authority. I think if I told them, I'm one of you, but because my grandfather was Jewish or whatever, they might have not been as obedient as we wanted them to be, and as forthcoming. I mean, they complimented me on my German, my faultless German. But when you just say, I was brought up like this with my mother. My mother spoke German to me. My father spoke English to me. End of story.
Now, anything else? Anything else about the denazification or any other tasks you were given in 1946?
Yes, there were two or three tasks. In 1946, before my demobilization, there was a constant exchange of populations. And
what do you mean?
Well, the Russians came over. Russian military delegation came over and started to select their citizens who were slave laborers. In they examined the displaced persons camp. I did go to one or two of these displaced persons camp with Russian officers, and because they were in our zone, these camps. So the Russian delegation went to the camps with me, because I had in the end the task of saying, yes, that's fine, those people are from the Ukraine, as far as we know, you can arrange repatriation.
How did they feel about that, the displaced people, persons?
That is a question which also fills me with great sadness. Among the people, there was a Ukrainian family who I befriended, because there was father, mother, young daughter, youngish daughter, and even a little boy. They were a whole family, and I think the father worked in munitions and the mother in something else. They came from the Ukraine, and when the Russians said, yes, you go back to Kiev, they actually fell down on their knees to me and say, for heaven's sake, don't send us back. I was very moved by this, because I was instrumental in sending them to what later transpired as probable death or deportation to Siberia.
But you didn't know that at the time.
I did not know that at the time. Don't forget, we were still allies. In fact, when I had to receive the Russian delegation in Bad Oeynhausen, where they were doing the selection process, I was invited to lunch with them, and they were fairly educated, these officers. My Russian was virtually non-existent, but I was invited for lunch, and I remember having in front of me a huge dish of scrambled eggs, a chunk of Russian rye bread. We dipped that into the eggs. There were about 10 of us around the table. I was the only Brit, and they were all Russians. And then the vodka bottle passed, no glasses. And of course, when the bottle came to me, I had to take a sip and pass it on to the next one. I went to my medical officer afterwards, who reassured me that the strength of the vodka would have destroyed any germs. The Russian sent all these people back, or we had to be actually helped to get the trains. And in retrospect, I felt almost like, you know, a person, when I found out what happened, like the people who deported the poor Jews, because the railway carriages were more comfortable than, they weren't cattle trucks, but nevertheless, I think some of these people went to their certain death, because Stalin just classified them as collaborators. We had then my next job was with Colonel Stedman, who was a finance officer. And he was very happy to have somebody like me.
So you were attached from Colonel Usher to Colonel Stedman?
No, they were all part of the military government department. But I was bandied around to various offices. Then Colonel Usher didn't have very much more to do. I'd taken him to Berlin. We went on one or two trips. But then I was loaned to Colonel Stedman. No, to Major Stedman.
Major, right.
Major Stedman, who was a chartered accountant. Now, I hadn't qualified as a chartered accountant. I was just up to the intermediate standard. That's why I was so anxious to get back to England to finish my career. But nevertheless, Major Stedman and I used to go to Minden and to all the towns, large towns, and investigate German financial institutions.
So what did that involve?
He gave me a glowing reference at the end when I was demobbed. I was a great help to him, he said, and we went through all large bank accounts where there were large movements of funds from one account to the other. It was a painstaking task, and the results were, of course, in some cases, money had gone into an account, a fairly large sum, and then was taken out again. At that time, money was, of course, the Deutsche Mark, German Mark was practically worthless. But nevertheless, we found that we caught one or several people who had acquired, no doubt illegally, fairly vast sums of money and put them into the bank account for hoping that one day they could transfer funds abroad, which, of course, at that time couldn't happen, didn't happen. I remember there was a case of, 100,000 marks going in and into an account, and we then, of course, caught up with the person and said, well, where did this money come from? And we had, this is where my training and Major Stedman, of course, had been in practice as chartered accountant. It came in very useful because they used to say the most ridiculous thing. And, oh, my grandmother had it, and she had it under the bed or something like that. We wouldn't accept that. And then it probably transpired that they had sold some stolen Jewish painting to another art dealer. It was an interesting job, albeit less dramatic than my other jobs.
Were you very aware of the black market? I'm not saying yes. You participated, or you might have done, but about it?
Yes. I can be perfectly honest about the black market. The German currency was virtually unacceptable. The black market, of course, flourished in the large towns like Berlin and Hamburg because people were starving, they were exchanging things. But we had what one might call a minor black market.
In Minden?
In Minden.
Well,
this was our the whole area in the towns. And I did not participate. The only thing I did steal was on my way to Germany, we went into a house where the coffee pot was still warm, and the only thing I did steal was out of the library of that house, library bookshelf, was a copy of Hitler's Mein Kampf in the original, which I took with me.
Still got on your shelf today.
Which I still have. I'll show it to you afterwards. In the Gothic print. No, the black market was, as far as we are concerned, we didn't steal, we didn't plunder, but we couldn't buy anything. However, I will tell you, I suffered a toothache in 1946, about 3 months before I was demobbed, and there was no leave I could look forward to immediately. Having to deal with this toothache, I saw Dr. Meyer in Minden, who was a German dentist. And I sat down and I said, can you do this? And he gave me a beautiful metal filling. And when it came to payment, he said, well, I usually charge 50 marks, which at that time was the equivalent of 10 cigarettes. As you know, cigarettes are in packs of 20, so I gave him a pack of 20. And he said, he was so grateful, he said, well, next time you come, I can do a bridge for you. I never saw him again. So the cigarettes were currency. And I do, apart from having this good dental treatment, I gave most of my cigarettes away, sent them to my aunt in Berlin, because at that time the postal services were good. So being a non-smoker, I found many worthy recipients for what was, in fact, currency. I remember my aunt actually got her windows replaced in her flat in Berlin for 200 cigarettes, which was a fortune.
Now, your financial investigations didn't cover any major black market players, did you? That's not what you're looking for, really.
No,
transfers
black,
of funds.
Black market players were not... Actually, black market players would not bank their ill-gotten gains. They would keep that in cash or change it for other things.
Yeah. So that's clear. Now, anything else about, we're moving through 46 now.
Well, I only remember one event which I found quite interesting. The bell of our house rang and was answered. We were allowed to have German staff like kitchen maids and people who made our beds and cooks as well. Because we were virtually living like civilians. I mean, we still had our sergeant's mess. And there were two events. One was that the bell rang and a young man looking quite fit came and wanted to see whoever was in charge, which was unfortunately myself, or fortunately. And I said, what do you want? He said, well, I have something to offer you. And he showed me a piece of gold, a little nugget of gold about this size.
Half an inch square,
less than about an ounce. And I said, oh yes, he said, I got this, where did you get it from? Oh, I got it from a dentist. I see. And at that time, of course, don't forget, it was 1946. Auschwitz, okay, had been liberated, but all the ins and outs had not been publicized so much. I said, dental gold. And yes, he said, yes, I got it from a dentist. I said, well, why? What did you give the dentist for that? Oh, I swapped it for something. Anyhow, the guy was suspicious. I had him arrested. And we handed him over to the military police as a potential guard in a concentration camp who had probably taken it. You know, they used to have gold. It was a nugget, you see, so obviously, had it been a coin... the situation might have been different.
And why was he trying to sell it to you, though, or to your lot?
Well, because, no, we were in the village and we were stationed there. He didn't want to sell it to a German, because the Germans had nothing, first of all, and we had money. He wanted cigarettes for it. He wanted cigarettes. Well, I had him arrested. Unfortunately, I could not follow this up, and I think I was demobbed then, and what happened to him, but I hope he was duly sentenced. Another event to show the mentality of the Germans, I had by that time my two friends whom I befriended, the sergeant from Hamburg and the